Syrian President Bashar al-Assad takes the oath of office following his re-election in the country's presidential vote in May. At least 160 people are confirmed dead in flooding in Germany and Belgium. Numbers are expected to rise as hundreds are still missing. And Russia reports over 25,000 new daily COVID-19 cases and 787 deaths. Hello and welcome to World News. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. First story this hour takes us to Syria, where President Bashar al-Assad has been sworn in for another seven-year term after winning the May election. Assad took the oath of office for the fourth time during an official ceremony at the presidential palace in Damascus. In an address, Assad hailed the Syrian people for their resistance against the enemy's plots. He said Syria would not be divided, added that all bets against his country have failed. The Syrian president also appreciated Iran and Russia's support for freeing his country from terrorists. He called it his priority to free other parts of Syria that are still in the hands of the terrorists, backed by Turkey and the United States. Assad won the presidential election by a landslide, securing more than 95% of the votes. This was his second victory since the foreign-backed insurgency engulfed the Arab country in 2011. Well, regarding Syrian President Bashar al-Assad and being sworn in for the fourth time a little while ago, we were joined by our correspondent, Mohammed Ali, who updated us about the official ceremony.
He also highlighted the importance of the next period in the economic sector in Syria. He said that work will be focused on renewable energy and investment in the country. As you know, we are in a very difficult situation, in Syria economic situation, in light of the destruction that happened by foreign-backed terrorism, also in light of the economic sanctions by the United States and the West Coast sanctions that have made the Syrian daily lives much more difficult and made it almost impossible for the Syrian government to import the basic needs for the Syrians every day. So definitely the most important priority for the Syrians and for the Syrian president and for the government currently will be the economic situation. He was focusing on the agricultural sector, on the industrial sector, on reopening all of the factories that were affected by the war in various parts of the country. So all the focus will be now on inside Syria, not on the outside like before the war. The agricultural sector, the investment sector, he will also be giving investments, necessarily giving investments for his allies that sit with it, for example, Iran, Russia, and China.
Representatives of the Afghan government and the Taliban have launched fresh peace talks in the Qatari capital of Doha. Several high-ranking officials, including former President Hamid Karzai and the head of the High Council for National Reconciliation, Abdullah Abdullah, are attending the negotiations. Now, the spokesman for the government's negotiating team said Kabul expects negotiators to make headway with the talks in a short time and to reach a result. He expressed hope that the talks will lead to a lasting peace in the country. Negotiations come as Taliban militants have stepped up their attacks on cities and villages and have captured a vast swath of territory. Now, the Afghan military has been engaged in fierce fighting with the militants in some areas to try to retake the control of those regions, including a southern border crossing with Pakistan. Turning to Europe now, where devastating floods have taken place in the western part of that continent, which have claimed at least 160 lives. That number could rise as rescuers are still searching for hundreds who are missing. Germany is the worst-hit country, where police say 133 people have died as a result of the disaster. A dam at risk of collapsing in North Rhine-Westphalia has forced the evacuation of thousands of people. Meanwhile, in Belgium, at least 27 deaths have been confirmed, and the interior minister says another 20 people are missing. The deluge has also submerged homes in Luxembourg and the Netherlands. The cost of damage in Europe's worst floods in decades is estimated at several billion euros. Now, efforts are being made to restore gas, electricity, and telephone services. Well, the European High Court of Justice has ruled in favor of European businesses who want to sack employees for wearing religious clothing in front of customers. Although the court did say that the ban was meant to be implemented fairly and neutrally, many predict that it will unfairly be used to target Muslim women, many of whom wear the hijab or niqab. Robert Carter reports from London.
Shock has rippled through the Muslim community after the European Union's highest court ruled that businesses can sack Muslim women for wearing the hijab if they work face-to-face with customers or if the wearing of the religious clothing causes workspace conflicts. The ruling was in response to a case brought by two German Muslim female workers who were asked by their employers not to wear Islamic headscarves while at work.
The decision has been met by claims that it will further fuel Islamophobia at this crucial time when countries in Europe such as France and Austria are already eliminating freedoms for Muslims, supposedly to combat extremism.
In Britain, several religious MPs, including Muslims and a Sikh, chastised the court, labelling the ruling as Islamophobic and deeply flawed. In addition, I spoke with a London-based female Muslim media personality about her fears for the future of Muslims in Europe.
To me, I feel oppressed, to be honest, by this decision. And I feel that I am now limited in my identity and my freedom of rights, freedom of belief, all the values that are actually supposedly meant to be Western, modern. Yes, part of it is a symbol of my faith, but it's so much more if you were to really understand what the hijab actually means, or any sort of religious symbol. It is not just coming from one aspect. I think it's really unfair, and it's, again, it is targeting a particular group, especially the Muslim women, because we are the ones that are known to be wearing the headscarf known as the hijab.
Many activists warned that following the niqab ban, European powers would target the hijab next. They were right. But if the battle to protect the hijab is lost, what comes next? Robert Carter, London.
Well, British Health Secretary Sajid Javid says he has tested positive for COVID-19 as the country faces a fresh surge of infections.
Hi, everyone. I just wanted to update you all that I've tested positive for COVID. I was feeling a bit groggy last night, so I took a lateral flow test this morning and it's come out positive. So I'm now self-isolating at home with my family until I get the results of a PCR test.
In the video posted on Twitter, the 51-year-old said he was fully vaccinated and his symptoms were very mild. Javid has been health secretary for only 3 weeks. He was named to the post after Matt Hancock resigned for breaching social distancing guidelines. Javid has supported Prime Minister Boris Johnson's plan to lift all lockdown restrictions in England on Monday. Scientists have warned that the move is a threat to the world and provides fertile ground for the emergence of vaccine-resistant variants. On Friday, Britain recorded more than 50,000 daily cases for the first time since mid-January. The country has the seventh highest COVID-19 death toll in the world. It has fully vaccinated two-thirds of its adult population. Meantime, Russia has reported over 25,000 coronavirus infections, taking the overall caseload to nearly 6 million. Authorities also said nearly 790 people died from the disease in 24 hours. That pushes the overall COVID-related death toll to more than 147,000. The country reported nearly 800 deaths on Friday, the highest in a single day since the pandemic broke out there. Russia has been in the grip of a surge in cases, with authorities blaming the Delta variant and people's reluctance to get vaccinated. The capital, Moscow, and the second largest city, St. Petersburg, remain the epicenters of the recent outbreak. Russia is the worst hit country in Europe by the pandemic in terms of both infections and deaths. Meanwhile, people have staged a march in the French capital to protest the government's new COVID-19 restrictions and vaccine mandates. Protesters voiced their anger at the new rules that President Emmanuel Macron announced earlier this week. The measures include mandatory vaccinations for all healthcare workers. Unvaccinated people would also require negative test results to enter public places. Demonstrations were also held in a number of other French cities, including Nantes and Montpellier. Critics complain the measures trample on freedom and discriminate against people who choose not to get vaccinated. Thousands of French citizens also marched on Wednesday to denounce the plan, which will take effect in August. The United States Air Force is sending dozens of F-22 fighter jets to the Pacific amid growing tensions with China. U.S. media say the country is deploying nearly 25 Raptors for an exercise in Guam and the Tinian Islands this month. That accounts for 25% of all missions F-22 aircraft in the U.S. fleet. Now, military officials say the U.S. has never deployed this amount of combat warplanes in its Pacific Air Force area of operation. They say the deployment would send an immediate message to China, especially at a time when the two countries are at odds over a variety of issues, including Taiwan and the South China Sea. Commentator Quinn Duzhu says the U.S. military deployment to the Pacific is a continuation of its policies to militarize the region, which is economically the most dynamic now.
Well, if you look at the U.S. strategy, you know, back to the Obama period, there was this pivot to Asia strategy. Part of that strategy is to redeploy 60% of the U.S. air and the naval force in the Asia-Pacific region. And the recent development of the F-20s, F-22, obviously, dozens of them, is the continuation of that strategy. So obviously, the U.S. is investing heavily and deepening that strategy, in a sense, to militarize the entire region here. You know, if you look at the region, this is the most dynamic region in the world in terms of economic growth. So, you know, folks in Washington, they are in this mood that they need to do something to contain China.
Now to Cuba, where the president there has denounced the dissemination of false images on social media as encouraging outrage and destruction of property. President Miguel Díaz-Canel says that what the world is seeing of Cuba is a lie. Now, the comments came 6 days after anti-government demonstrations over the worst economic crisis in the Caribbean country. One person died, and over 100 others were arrested during the protests. The government has blamed the economic woes mainly on U.S. sanctions and the coronavirus pandemic. The discovery of several mass graves containing the remains of children who attended residential schools in Canada has renewed the debate on the historic mistreatment of Indigenous people in that country. Researchers say the graves found so far are only the tip of the iceberg.
The discovery of an unmarked graveyard at a former residential school run by the Catholic Church in the Canadian province of British Columbia in May, which contained at least 215 human remains, mostly young children, prompted an outpouring of grief and anger and a wider investigation into similar boarding schools that were open from the late 19th century to the mid-1990s. The probes have so far found some 1,100 bodies at the sites of former residential schools in the provinces of British Columbia and Saskatchewan. A Canadian researcher whose works contributed to the uncovering of the first mass grave has said the discoveries so far have barely scratched the surface. The residential school system in Canada was established in 1883 under the country's first Prime Minister, Sir John A. Macdonald. The aim was to assimilate Indigenous peoples in Canada and destroy their languages and culture. By the 1920s, attending residential schools had been made mandatory for children aged between 7 and 15.
These have been going on for years. The residential school survivors just basically were ignored. Now today, it seems a shock to some people, but it shouldn't be a shock because this was known that it was the policy in Canada. It was also the policy in the United States. They just pulled these kids out of their homes, and they wanted to indoctrinate them. And that's exactly what they tried to do.
Some 150,000 children were separated from their parents, often under threats of persecution.
Well, so far, 1,323 bodies have been discovered at various sites across Canada. For over a century, Canada's residential school system separated First Nation children from their families and exposed them to all sorts of abuse. The mistreatment of the children, some as young as three, is well within living memory. How can the Canadian government redress the grievances of the First Nations population?
The first mass grave in British Columbia was found after Indigenous elders recollected the memories of young children digging holes in the ground. The survivors have told harrowing stories of how the mistreatment and abuse the children were subjected to at the former residential schools led some to attempt suicide or try to escape.
Many of our children who ran away during the winter and froze to death on their way home. And the clients, the black robes, start lying about the children. Oh yeah, they're doing fine here. In the meantime, they were missing. And no one had searched for them.
A former student of the Cooper Island Industrial School has described the place as Canada's Alcatraz. In a 2015 report, the Truth and Reconciliation Commission of Canada called the practices employed in the former schools, quote, cultural genocide.
We're trying to say, people are trying to say now, cultural genocide. It just doesn't fit in the description of the word genocide. Defined by the United Nations. I mean, it's very clear that that's what they did.
These are the hard truths that are part of Canada's history. These are the hard truths we must confront as a society.
The Canadian government has vowed to fulfill the Indigenous people's demands to fund investigations into the graves around the country. But it's come under criticism for failing to do so earlier, as the discoveries made so far have been funded by the Indigenous groups themselves. The First Nations leaders say over 6,000 children died at the schools from causes like disease, accident, and suicide, but there's no clear picture of how many children lost their lives throughout the years. That means there will be more headlines about mass graves discoveries around Canada in the months to come.
And with that, brings us to the end of this World News Bulletin. Thank you all so much for staying with us.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
چیزی که انسان را مطمئن می کند ذکر خداست، ذکر الله تطمئن القلوب.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
I invite you to listen to a short part of the book Sirr al-Salat, The Secret of Prayer, written by Imam Khomeini, Some Discipline and Secrets of Takbirs, and the Eradication of Hands. Express being weak toward the divinity and ask for being forgiven for the fault and sins you committed. After that, repeat Takbir, open your heart's eyes as to hear the invitation. And if the sweetness of the presence and the pleasure of entering or the greatness of the presence will be appeared in your heart, you must know that you are allowed to enter. Now repeat while being wailing and begging, My head is at thy command and prosperity is thy and wickedness has no way toward thee.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته Today we are with another saying of Imam Khomeini. In one of his sayings, Imam Khomeini has said that Islam is at the service of downtrodden. The people who have been oppressed through the times, the people who were downtrodden, who were treated badly by the people in the power, the people who were oppressed by the oppressors. Islam is at the service of such people. Islam is at the service of the people who've been treated badly. In the history, we can see how Prophet ﷺ is making slaves free, how he is buying the slaves from the polytheists of Mecca, the mushrikeen of Mecca, who used to oppress, who used to treat badly the slaves, and then when he used to buy them, he used to free them for the sake of Islam.
Ya Hayyu Ya Qayyum, Ya Hayyu Ya Qayyum, Ya Hayyu Ya Qayyum, Ya Hayyu Ya Qayyum.
Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam, he was making them free for Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, because every single child is born as a free person. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says in the Quran that every single of you is born free. You're not born as a slave. This trait of making slaves, this trait of slavery, Islam is all against it. Islam is at the service of downtrodden, and Islam is talking against, or it raises its voice against, these kinds of oppression. We can see in the history the example of Hazrat Bilal and the other companions of the prophets who were treated badly by their owners, and when Islam came, Islam freed them all.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
إلا الله
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Africa Today.
A senior United States military commander recently warned of what he termed as wildfire of terrorism sweeping across Africa at the conclusion of massive US-led war games in the continent. In trying to justify Washington's meddling in Africa, he further claimed that insecurity in the continent threatens the United States.
Once they take root in Africa, they'll spread to Europe and eventually to the United States. It's a threat to the United States. It may not be a threat to the U.S. homeland right now. It is definitely a threat to America's interests in the world.
Hello and a warm welcome to another edition of Africa Today, a program which gives you an incisive analysis on events taking place in Africa. This week's edition is focusing on how the United States is using the pretext of combating terrorism to destabilize African countries while pursuing its hegemonic interests. In the second segment of our program, we shall discuss the situation in the strategic Horn of Africa region, where major global powers are rushing to establish their military presence. Join us as our experts examine these two subjects.
U.S. military destabilizing Africa. General Stephen Townsend, head of the United States Africa Command, commonly known as AFRICOM, has painted a dark picture of threats throughout Africa. Speaking in mid-June after war games dubbed African Lion, held mostly in Morocco, Townsend claimed that Africa will experience a new wave of terrorism. Townsend warned of terrorism in Africa, yet the terror groups spreading mayhem in Africa are the products of the extremist ideology spread by Saudi Arabia, a key US ally in the region. All major terrorist groups operating in Africa, such as Boko Haram, Al-Shabaab, and several other groups affiliated to Al-Qaeda and Daesh terror groups, all strictly adhere to the Saudi Wahhabi ideology.
The creation of the United States Africa Command is part of a familiar pattern used by the U.S. to spread its hegemonic tentacles across the world. An African-American activist expounds here. Let's take a listen.
You know, just like Afghanistan, going after the Taliban was the broader excuse for going into a geostrategically important region. Just like, you know, the United States allying with any particular country is allegedly for something, protecting democracy and freedom versus something else. It's the same thing that we have. We have the same situation here in Africa post 9/11, which is that it's used as a pretext. Terrorism, quote unquote, is used as a pretext, a twofold pretext.
For more on U.S. military adventurism in Africa, we have contacted Tshepo Magama. He's a political activist and a former member of South African Parliament. Welcome to our show.
No, thank you for having me.
Now, the U.S. claims its troops are in Africa to combat terrorism. Yet, despite decades-long U.S. presence in the continent, terrorism has continued to increase. Now, what's your take on this?
You know, the U.S. has been less interested in issues of terrorism or generally, you know, security and safety for the African continent. I mean, for the U.S., it has always been, you know, advancement of their geopolitical and strategic interests across the world. Their real engagement on the African continent, you know, was really during the post-Second World War, but during the Cold War period, you know, when the U.S. was indeed trying to extend its dominance across, especially countries that were fighting for their independence, you know, from the 1940s, 1950s, and 1960s. And so the U.S.'s role on the African continent has really been characterized by, you know, an entire geopolitical and strategic outlook that sought to entrench the U.S. hegemony across the globe. And, of course, fighting the Soviet Union. And so what we see with the U.S. role in countries like Niger, in Somalia, and elsewhere, you know, is really a continuation of that kind of thinking in the United States of America.
Tshepo Magama, thank you for that.
The U.S. is the foreign power with the highest military presence in Africa. According to reports, the U.S. has at least 29 known outposts across the northern, western, eastern, and Horn regions of Africa. Although AFRICOM is spreading its tentacles throughout Africa under the guise of combating terrorism, most Africans are now increasingly becoming aware of the long-term dangers posed by the imperialist military forces, as this expert here explains.
If you ask local communities, locals see it again as sort of a new form of neocolonialism, a new form of sort of an extra sort of security blanket.
Mr. Magama, what do you think are the hidden objectives of regular U.S. military drills in Africa?
Well, the United States really is its primary objective at the moment is to extend and deepen, you know, U.S. hegemony. I think that's the first thing. But the second track really is the U.S. wants to hold on as long as possible. You know, to its preeminent, so-called preeminent position as the superpower of the globe. And so what you see in terms of U.S. strategy on the African continent is really around, you know, issues of so-called terrorism diplomacy, issues of so-called security, which they do not bring to any of the African countries in particular, but also in countries in Asia and in Latin America and elsewhere. And so this is part of that broader game that the U.S. is playing, you know, with no real input, you know, on improving the conditions of the people of the Global South in general, but of Africa in particular.
Well, the commander of the U.S. Africa Command recently alleged that China has been in contact with countries as far north as Mauritania and as far south as Namibia on establishing a naval facility with the capability to host submarines or aircraft carriers. Now, Mr. Magama, AFRICOM commander has expressed concern over China's growing military influence in Africa. Do we expect to see confrontation between these two powers in Africa?
What we see really is a broader strategy of the United States using, you know, all their instruments of foreign policy, chief of which, of course, has always been the military, to try to counter China and what they refer to as Chinese influence on the African continent, as if Africans don't have agency.
The 2021 edition of the African Lion military drill took place near the disputed region of Western Sahara. In the December of last year, former United States President Donald Trump broke with years of international consensus to recognize Morocco's claim to the disputed territory of Western Sahara. The recognition was part of a deal in which Morocco agreed to normalize ties with the Israeli regime. The African Union and dozens of countries recognize Western Sahara as an independent state.
Speaking when he hosted President Brahim Ghali of the Sahrawi Arab Democratic Republic, South African President Cyril Ramaphosa said the liberation of Africa is incomplete without the liberation of Western Sahara.
We are certain that the people of Western Sahara will be free one day. Our liberation and the liberation of our continent will not be complete without the liberation of Western Sahara.
Now, it's the U.S. recognition of Moroccan sovereignty over Western Sahara, followed by military drills near this region, an affront to the African Union?
The African Union is the premier institution of the African peoples and African countries. And there is no way that the United States, acting as an imperial overlord, will dictate to the African people, you know, what positions we should take. In fact, on 21 March of this year, the African Union again reconfirmed its position that, you know, the question of Western Sahara must be dealt with in accordance with previous decisions of the United Nations Security Council and consistent, of course, with the African Union's own position. And so, you know, the deal struck by the U.S. and the Moroccan government is a deal that is doomed to fail, because really what it was meant to do, similar to what Israel did with the other Arab states, was really clearly to try to vitiate, to try to liquidate the Palestinian question. In this case, to try to liquidate the question of Western Sahara.
Thank you for that, Mr. Magama.
The African Union is concerned about foreign military bases on the continent, as this goes against the concept of African solutions to African problems. In a bid to discourage foreign forces from setting base in the continent, the African Union is engaged in regional efforts to combat terrorism. Ambassador Fatima Mohammed, the permanent observer of the African Union to the United Nations, elaborates here on regional efforts to combat terrorism in Africa.
The African Union peace support operations and ad hoc security coalitions have also significantly degraded the capabilities of some of the terrorist groups in the different sub-regions. At the national level, the criminal justice response to terrorism have also been strengthened with the adoption of the anti-terrorism legislation and the enhanced capacities of law enforcement agencies. There are also growing efforts by our member states to better understand and address the political, social, and economic situation and conditions that make it conducive for the spread of violent ideologies.
Our last question to you, Mr. Magama, now. Can African countries defeat terrorism without interference by Western military powers, especially the U.S.?
We know that the terrorism that we face on the African continent, you know, was sponsored and in many instances still continues to be sponsored by very close allies of the United States in the Middle East. And so, you know, their attempt to, you know, purely look at a military solution to what clearly is a situation that cannot be resolved merely by the military, you know, is of course a manifestation or a yes witness to the United States approach to issues of national security. I mean, look, if you are a hammer or all you have is a hammer, of course everything looks like a nail. And so that has been the U.S.'s approach to issues of global insecurity, without taking a comprehensive view of the root causes and other socioeconomic issues that might be underlying the terrorism.
Well, you have it there. The military approach being imposed by the U.S. on African countries cannot eliminate terrorism in the continent. Thank you for that insight, Mr. Magama, a former member of the South African Parliament. Now, we shall take a short break, and when we come back, our guest will give an analysis on the scramble for the Horn of Africa. Don't go away.
Scramble for the Horn of Africa.
The Horn of Africa, a region that basically includes Eritrea, Djibouti, Somalia, and Ethiopia, is of great importance to regional and global powers due to its geopolitical and strategic considerations. Now, this region is now an epicenter of foreign military presence in Africa, with at least 13 foreign military bases.
Djibouti, a tiny Horn of Africa nation, plays host to naval bases of world and regional powers from the United States, Japan, France, Italy, Spain, and most recently China and Saudi Arabia. In 2017, China opened its first overseas military base in Djibouti. A Chinese foreign ministry spokesperson explains here on the importance of the base.
The base will help China to better fulfill its international obligation in Somali waters, such as carrying out escort missions and providing humanitarian aid. It will also benefit Djibouti in social and economic development and enable China to make further contribution in safeguarding peace and stability in Africa and the world.
The U.S. also recently appointed its first ever special envoy to the Horn of Africa, Jeffrey Feltman. Now, this led to fears that the region is set for more destabilizing moves by the U.S. and its allies. For more analysis on the apparent scramble for the Horn of Africa, we have contacted Lawrence Freeman, a political economic analyst for Africa. Thank you for your time, Mr. Freeman.
You're welcome.
Now, our first question to you. The United States has appointed a special envoy for the Horn of Africa. What's the real reason behind this appointment, and should we expect more meddling in the region by Washington?
But the situation in the Horn of Africa is very important strategically to the United States and to the West as a whole. Ethiopia has been a very strong ally of the United States for many decades, both on the Republican and Democratic presidential administrations. And the special envoy Feltman now has made a trip to the region, will be making another trip. And unfortunately, he's acting against the interest of the United States, which unfortunately is the policy of the United States. They have now turned against Ethiopia for the moment, a long-standing ally. And the special envoy, following the policy of the Tony Blinken, the Secretary of State, is not playing a helpful role in the region.
Now, early June, Saudi Arabia's foreign minister met Jeffrey Feltman in Riyadh. UAE's foreign minister also met Feltman to coordinate Horn of Africa strategies. Now, Mr. Freeman, as we have seen, Feltman recently visited some Persian Gulf monarchies. What roles are these countries playing in advancing Washington's interest in the Horn of Africa?
The Biden administration has adopted this view that the U.S. will impose democracy dictatorship and human rights dictatorship on countries throughout the world, and is trying to force countries to behave in a way that they find acceptable to their view of liberal democracy. Unfortunately, this is having a very bad effect. The situation in Ethiopia is very difficult, and the U.S. is playing a very bad role at points by weakening the administration of Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed. They have a history of ethnic tensions where the government in Addis Ababa is struggling against various groups of ethno-nationalists to preserve the nation state. And some of the actions by the United States are actually weakening the government and weakening the nation.
The presence of rival foreign military bases in Djibouti has led to mutual accusation, especially between the US and China. For instance, in 2018, the Pentagon claimed Chinese nationals pointed lasers at US military aircraft in Djibouti. China's defense ministry said the US accusations were false.
This activity poses a threat to our airmen. We have formally demarched the Chinese government. And we've requested that the Chinese investigate these incidents.
Now, after strict verification, we have told the U.S. side that what they alleged is absolutely untrue.
Djibouti is the only nation hosting both U.S. and Chinese military bases. So is there any danger that these two superpowers will face off in this strategic Horn of Africa state?
Trump used Africa and made his foreign policy in Africa through John Bolton, his national security advisor, to stop China, counter China in Africa. The Biden administration is also out to stop China and counter China's efforts, and is taking a slightly different approach, but the intent is the same, that both the Trump and the Biden administrations suffer from the disease of geopolitics. They don't want to conceive of a world where countries are working together for the development of all people and all nations. They view the world as a zero-sum game. So if China is making progress and developing its economy and helping other economies, that is seen as a danger to those who follow the idiocy of geopolitics. And therefore, the Chinese must be kept down according to geopolitical doctrine. This is the same view the Trump administration has. It's the same view the Biden administration has. So yes, Africa can become a chessboard for warfare by the United States against China.
Ethiopia, the largest Horn of Africa country, has been experiencing internal instability and is also involved in a dispute with neighboring Sudan and Egypt over its construction of a giant dam on the Nile. Now, Egypt's President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi says his country's share of the Nile's river waters are untouchable in a stark warning, apparently, to Ethiopia, which is filling a giant new dam on the Nile's main tributary.
No one can take a single drop of water from Egypt, and whoever wants to try it, let them try. I'm not threatening anyone here. Our dialogue is always reasonable and rational. No one can take a drop from Egypt's water, and if it happens, there will be inconceivable instability in the region.
Now, the Ethiopia dam dispute is threatening to ignite more instability in the Horn of Africa region. How are foreign powers fueling this dispute?
The GERD dam, which is in the process of a second filling, is not a danger to any country. The water will pass through the turbine and return to the Nile. None of the water is being taken for agriculture or any other development, unlike the Nile water in Egypt, which is. There is no danger. This is an effort which we saw in the Trump administration and the Biden administration, even though they say they disagree with Trump on everything, are doing the same stupid thing that Trump did, which is they're trying to intervene to pressure Ethiopia to give in to Egypt, because they want Egypt as a political player to use in their brinkmanship with Hamas and the Palestinian Authority, which Egypt has a way of conducting dialogue with them and Israel. Sudan has no reason to object to the dam, except it's being blackmailed to do so.
Somalia has one of the most protracted conflicts in Africa. This Horn of Africa nation has been torn apart by civil war since 1992, when clan-based warlords overthrew a dictator. The country is now gripped by deadly attacks perpetrated by Al-Shabaab Takfiri terrorists. Somalia has accused foreign countries, including U.S. allies such as the United Arab Emirates, of destabilizing the country.
The monitoring group further stated that the establishment of a foreign military base in Berbera involving the transfer of military material to the territory will constitute a violation of arms embargo on Somalia.
Now, Mr. Freeman, my last question to you. What are the reasons for the continued destabilization of Somalia, a major Horn of Africa state?
The overall policy that the U.S. has for the Horn of Africa is absent of any concept of economic growth. The situation in Somalia is one of the poorest undeveloped countries in Africa. There are other countries like that. And what they have needed, the overall situation of the Horn of Africa, because of its strategic location in the Gulf of Aden along the Indian Ocean, because of the growth of Al-Shabaab and other extremist violent groups, that should be one of development. Ethiopia has 110 million people. Most of these people are poor. The majority of these people have no electricity. That's the same situation in Somalia. We should treat the region as a regional concern and promote a policy where we actually bring the people in Ethiopia and Somalia out of poverty. If you eliminate poverty and you eliminate hunger, you can bring stability to the region, and that's what our policy should be.
Mr. Freeman there says elimination of poverty will restore stability in the Horn of Africa region. Thanks a lot, Mr. Freeman, and unfortunately our time is up for today. On behalf of my colleagues here, I would like to thank you all. Have a great time and goodbye for now.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Badr 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
Thank you. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.